Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Right now, salmon are making the miraculous journey from the Pacific Ocean up the Columbia to the place where each fish was born. All salmon ask for is a river with cool flowing water, but because of the stagnant reservoirs behind dams, as well as climate change, the Columbia heats up in July and August way above the safe level for salmon. Today we talk with Brett Vandenhoevel, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about what can be done to cool the water so that salmon can safely return to their spawning grounds. Brett, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. I'm happy to be here with you.
Social distance as we are.
Yes.
Well, this subject that we're going to be talking about today, which is how warm the Columbia River is and how difficult that is for salmon, is something that we've been talking about for decades, and I don't know how many shows that I've done about this issue. And when I got an email requesting doing a show about this and having you on, I thought, well, I'm glad to do this show, but why are we still talking about this? Why is it that those four dams in the Snake River haven't been decommissioned? Why are we still struggling with the same issue that's been an ongoing problem for a very, very long time?
Yeah, I think the good news is that it's getting more attention right now. We are moving towards solutions, I hope, of bringing more people together, looking at Snake River Dam removal as part of sort of a regional solution, you know, looking at things like shipping wheat on the Columbia, the transportation issues, looking at agricultural issues, and trying to, you know, we're pushing our elected leaders to come up with a solution that, you know, is something that's good for the Pacific Northwest and all those stakeholders, and prevents salmon runs from going extinct. You know, it's a really urgent time. And I know there's a little bit of a, you know, 20 years ago, there was a push for dam removal. It didn't work. And now there is new energy and new urgency around this. And I'm probably the most hopeful I've been around some of these issues, because I think people see how urgent it is.
Well, I was curious when I got that email about why you wanted to take on this subject right now. A lot of the time in the last couple of years, we've been talking about stopping a methanol refinery in Kalama. We've been talking about stopping the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal in Coos Bay. And we've been talking lately about the pandemic and about Black Lives Matter. So I wonder, why do you feel this is an appropriate time to start talking once again about how to cool down the Columbia River?
Well, all of these things are connected in different ways. You know, there's definitely a social justice aspect of not letting salmon go extinct, and upholding the treaties the United States government has with tribal nations. And we are fighting like hell against fossil fuel projects that are, you know, destroying our climate. But at the same time, the rivers continue to get hotter and hotter each year, in part because of climate change, but also the main driver of this threat to salmon is the dams. And the reason we need to talk about this right now is that the rivers have become too hot for long-term salmon survival. And we're going to lose runs of salmon unless we do something about this now. It is not the ideal time to talk about this. There are many other pressing issues. But, you know, we continue to think that saving salmon is a real urgent issue. And there are, you know, regulatory processes the federal government is going through. There's lawsuits. There's all these things that are kind of coming together right now that make this kind of a do or die situation for dam removal.
Well, for those listeners who aren't familiar with the lay of the land of the Columbia Basin, I want to just have you describe the river. And let's start at the source of the river up in British Columbia and talk about what salmon have been blocked from a lot of that run. But let's talk about what historically, where the salmon could travel and how that's been transformed over the last 80, 90 years.
Yeah, so the Columbia starts in a lake in British Columbia and flows north for a while and takes a big turn to the south, and it's over 1,200 miles long, crosses the British Columbia border, and pretty quickly runs into the Grand Coulee Dam. And the Grand Coulee Dam blocked fish passage. There was not and is not any way for salmon to get above Grand Coulee right now. And so that's the extent of where salmon are swimming upstream. It's actually just below that. The dam below Grand Coulee also didn't put in fish ladders. That's where the salmon are blocked. And so all of that habitat in British Columbia is now off limits to salmon. And, you know, the people up there and the First Nations that depended on salmon for so long, you know, there's horrible stories about their fishing communities that are completely shut off from salmon. And, you know, the government sending people canned salmon or canned tuna as reparations for taking away their livelihood. And so there's very tragic stories of salmon being blocked from what is now British Columbia. And they also built large dams, which are part of the Columbia River Treaty in Canada and the U.S. And there's an arrangement now where it has flooded big, huge canyons in British Columbia. And the U.S. has a treaty with Canada to release, you know, that water when we want it, essentially, for hydropower. Grand Coulee then continues to flow down through Washington, central Washington, past the Hanford Reach on the Columbia is an important place. And then the Snake River comes in near the Tri-Cities in Washington. And the Snake River is a major tributary of the Columbia. And there are four dams on the lower Snake River in eastern Washington that block tremendous, amazing habitat for salmon to reach. So not only are the dams warming up the Snake River to a level that's too hot for salmon survival, they're also blocking access to some really pristine mountain habitat that salmon need for spawning. And then, yeah, as we know, the river curves around and starts heading west along the Washington-Oregon border and passes several more dams until the estuary in the Pacific Ocean.
So the big difference between the dams that are in the lower part of the Columbia River below the Snake River confluence and the ones that are above are that the ones that are below at least supposedly have fish passage. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's fish ladders on the Columbia River below the Chief Joseph and Grand Coulee dams, and the adult salmon can go up the so-called fish ladders and make it past the dam. There is mortality for doing that. You know, some fish don't make it. And then the other problem is the juvenile fish coming down. Also, there's mortality where they're either getting ground up in the turbines or they're not making it out the other side. And so the dams have radically altered the flow and the entire system of the Columbia River. And because of that, salmon as well.
For a number of years, I've heard people talk, and I've been involved in discussions about what it would be like to take out the dams. And I get the sense that it's a lot easier to think about taking out the Snake River dams than it is to take out those four dams that are below the Snake River. Though I've heard more talk about taking out John Day Dam, and we could talk about why the John Day Dam is particularly a problem. Let's talk about that, and then we can get back to what's going on the Snake River.
Sure, yeah. So just last year, Yakima Nation called on Indigenous Peoples Day, called for removal of lower Columbia River dams of Bonneville, the Dalles, and the John Day dams. You know, that is a bold vision of looking forward. And I don't think they were calling for it tomorrow, but to think about if we do want to build a clean energy future that doesn't drive salmon to extinction, we need to be thinking about something else beyond dams. And nobody wants to replace that power with coal or fracked gas or you know, dirty fossil fuels. And so thinking about putting in place and truly renewable energy like solar and being able to replace that power from those dams and starting that planning process now, there's certainly, you know, serious concerns a lot of people would have with that for the transportation. You know, the dams allow barges to go up and down the Columbia River, but we supported Yakima Nation's call and stood in solidarity with them at the drowned Celilo Falls last year when they were calling for that. So yes, I think we are in an era coming forward of dam removal, not building new dams. And we think that the Snake River dams are what we are focused on as a much needed and realistic goal of restoring some really critical salmon habitat. And I know that Yakima Nation is thinking about the future as well throughout the basin.
In talking about the removing the Snake River dams, I've heard a lot of people talking about how they're not particularly useful, that they don't do the things that they were promised to do. And I sort of got a pretty strong sense of that when I was able to take a tugboat ride up the Columbia River back in 2002 when I was working on a radio documentary. It was called Rivers That Were, about what the Columbia River was like before it was dammed and what the dams have done to really transform it in some very negative ways. And so I asked Tidewater Barge, I said, I'd like to take a ride all the way up to Lewiston. And so the response was, well, we don't run very many tugs up to Lewiston. In fact, they only go up, I don't remember, maybe once a week or something. It was very few. And then it wound up, I could just take a ride from the Bonneville Dam to the Dalles Dam, which was really enough to get a sense of what that's all about and what the culture of the barge operators, the tug operators is. But after that, I thought a lot about how they just are reinforcing what people who've been trying to get the serious discussion going about removing the Snake River dams, it was reinforcing that argument. So just how necessary are those Snake River dams, and why is it so inviting for people who are trying to restore salmon to target those dams first?
I think the first reason the Snake River dams are necessary to be removed is the Snake River is such important habitat for salmon, and there is intact spawning habitat in some, you know, wilderness area and other land in Idaho that would could be accessed by salmon if those dams weren't there. I mean, those dams do have fish passage, but they're particularly for Snake River sockeye and steelhead, they're absolutely killers of those fish. And so one, it's the habitat potential itself. The second part is that the dams make the river hot. We've known this for a long time, that the stagnant reservoirs are absorbing solar radiation and warming up the river. The dams are causing that problem, and it's getting worse because of climate change. So we're in a real crisis time, and we can talk about that more, what those numbers look like. But so these dams don't produce a huge amount of power. Historically, hydropower in the Pacific Northwest has been very inexpensive. That's not true anymore. The Bonneville Power Administration has historically sold excess power to California and made a lot of profit that way because of the vast increase in solar and renewable energy in California. That market has sort of dried up. And if you look at the prices now over the last, you know, 5 years of hydropower compared to something like renewables, that hydropower isn't the cheapest thing on the market anymore. And so, you know, the case for Snake River Dam removal is it's not a huge amount of power. We can replace that with truly renewable energy. And it's not inexpensive anymore. And so there is a real opportunity to protect and restore salmon without losing much on the energy side of the equation.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Brett Vandenhoevel, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about what can be done to cool the Columbia River so that salmon can safely return to their spawning grounds. I find it kind of interesting that and a little bit disturbing sometimes, that people who live around the Puget Sound like to boast about how they get all totally renewable energy because their energy all comes from hydropower. And it's coming from those dams between the McNary Dam and the Grand Coulee Dam up in Washington, I think, which are, of course, salmon-killing dams. So there's two parts to this. Is one, what you just said, that hydropower is not really that cheap anymore compared to other renewables. And the other part of it is, how do we debunk the myth that hydropower is a clean, green, renewable source of energy?
Hydropower, to its credit, doesn't have carbon emissions. There is more and more evidence that there is methane that's being emitted in the reservoirs, and that is, you know, a potent greenhouse gas, but there is not, say, a smokestack, but the radical changes that have happened to the river and the species that live in the river due to the dams is not something we can ignore. You know, no one today would build something that would wipe out a major species, would build a power plant that was going to wipe, if we knew it was going to wipe out an iconic species like salmon. And so it's a problem in that it allows people to say we're not having carbon emissions. But there's many other impacts to the dams as well. And I think that's kind of hitting home more now. You know, the Columbia River has, and Snake River has received a lot more attention in Puget Sound because of the Orca connection. I don't think many people knew this until the last few years, and that the southern resident killer whales that are struggling in Puget Sound, and we saw that horrific video of the mother pushing around the dead calf for I think it was 17 days, and those orcas are struggling in part because they feed on Columbia River fish. They come down to the mouth of the Columbia in the late winter and spring, and you know that population historically gorged on fish, on Chinook that were Columbia Basin fish and Snake River fish, and those adult salmon, as they were coming back, were allowing those orcas to fill up and pack on the pounds and provide nutrients and fat to be it for childbirth, or I mean not childbirth, for calf birth. And now that those populations of Chinook have drastically declined, those orcas are starving. And so for anyone who cares about the orca in Puget Sound, the solution has to do with the Columbia and Snake Rivers and bringing back more salmon.
Well, it's interesting. I actually learned about that connection when I was up in Tacoma working on my last project and went to a whole bunch of rallies about, well, they were nominally about stopping Tacoma LNG and about stopping Kalama methanol, but there was a lot of talk about the resident orcas. And I was up there the summer 2 years ago when Tahlequah, the mother orca, was pushing her dead calf around the Puget Sound for quite a while. And people started talking about how to save the resident orcas in Puget Sound, they needed to take out the Snake River dams, and they're calling on Governor Inslee to do that. And it was very interesting to see it from the perspective up there, because this is something I've thought about in terms of the Columbia River salmon. So I see that as a really powerful connection, and I wonder how you see that as a way to spread a lot more understanding of the damage that these dams do, and then maybe we can start talking after we get rid of the Snake River dams about the damage that the more useful utilitarian Columbia River dams are doing.
Yeah, the salmon are what connect people and ecosystems throughout the Columbia River Basin, and that is a very powerful thing. And it turns out it's beyond the Columbia River Basin, right? It's, you know, up into Puget Sound, and we've seen a lot more attention to the Columbia for the reason you just said. The southern resident killer whales, a major part of their diet is Columbia and Snake River Chinook. You know, a lot of orcas, other populations of orcas, will feed on sea lions and other marine mammals, and these fish have evolved to, probably for a while, it was a very good strategy to come down and, you know, have their diet rely on Chinook salmon because there were so many. And now that has dramatically decreased, they're really struggling.
And they don't eat anything else besides Chinook, my understanding, or at least it would take an awful lot for them to eat some other food.
They eat salmon. Yeah. They eat some different species of salmon, and the Chinook are the biggest and the best. But yeah, they're not going to suddenly start eating sea lions because they have, you know, evolved for thousands of years to depend on this amazing food source of salmon. And so the politics of Washington are, you know, centered in Puget Sound. We've in Olympia and Seattle, and it sometimes feels like it's hard to get attention down on the Columbia River from the powers that be. But, you know, Governor Inslee, to his credit, is, you know, there's an orca task force set up trying to come up with some solutions, and you know, the best and perhaps only solution to immediately restoring some salmon numbers is Snake River Dam removal. And Governor Brown in Oregon has come out in support of dam removal and has expressed that to Governor Inslee. And we're hopeful that, Governor Inslee will support that as well and try to push the federal government to take some truly bold solutions instead of, you know, continuing to have work groups.
Well, I wanted to talk about why the reservoirs behind the Snake River dams are that much more toxic to salmon than the reservoirs behind the Columbia River dams.
The big problem with the reservoirs on both the Columbia and the Snake is temperature, is how hot they're making the river. There's other problems with the reservoir. You know, they decrease the time that juvenile salmon are out migrating by changing a fast free-flowing river into a, you know, series of lakes. But the temperature issue has become more and more urgent. And so unlike a free-flowing river that is moving through quickly and is relatively shallow, the reservoirs are expanding the surface area of the river and allowing, you know, the river to get hotter. It's just kind of stagnant water is going to be hotter than free-flowing water, and it's also just a better, bigger surface area to absorb the sun. And these reservoirs aren't deep. You know, I think some people picture reservoirs as these, you know, 300 feet deep things, like maybe some of the Hoover Dam or other deeper reservoirs are, but these are what's called run-of-the-river dams, and the reservoirs are pretty shallow. You know, they actually dredge them for barges to go through up through here in the gorge and beyond, and so there are deep places of them, but there's not really thermal stratification where there's colder water on the bottom. You know, it's just all warm, and the safe level for salmon that scientists have determined for salmon survival is 68 degrees Fahrenheit. It's sort of the maximum water can get. Salmon are cold water species. And so for spawning, they need it even cooler, but just simply migration up the river, swimming in the river, if it's above 68, it can lead to disease, it can cause death and eventually. And so right now, the Snake River is way hotter than 68 degrees, you know, in the Columbia River as well. And that's caused by the dams warming up the water. And so that's the big problem with the reservoirs, is they're creating hot water, both on the Columbia and the Snake River. On the Snake River, it's way too hot for way too long of the year for salmon survival.
Well, that's also a lot because of the geography that it goes through. I mean, the Snake River dams are really in a desert. The Columbia River dams are in a transition zone to a desert, I guess. And then also, isn't the Snake River a lot shallower as a river and smaller than the Columbia River?
Yeah, there's a lot less flow, and so it's heating up. It's heating up faster. And there's other dams further upstream on the Snake too. But yeah, that's right. So when the salmon are migrating up through, the Snake River is in the summer, you know, and generally the same for the Columbia, depending on what the run is. But Snake River sockeye are going up in, say, June, and then the fall Chinook and summer Chinook are going up now. And so during these hottest times of the year is when the salmon are trying to migrate up through the river. And that 68 degree maximum level, you know, the Snake River is violating it, not for a couple days of the summer, it's now for a couple months consistently. So during our hottest months, you know, late July, August, early September, the river is violating the safe level for salmon, and that's also violating the legal limits. You know, it is against the law. It violates the Clean Water Act to allow the river to be over 68 degrees.
Well, another thing that is interesting, you mentioned that it takes the baby salmon a lot longer to get across the reservoirs than it would if they were going down a free-flowing river. But what I learned actually when I was doing my first big salmon project was that actually the baby salmon historically wouldn't actually swim down the river. Is that true? They would just like be carried down the river backwards, is what I understand.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, you hear people describe it as, you know, floating down, rushing down in these spring freshets tail first. And I think that would depend on where the flow was and what was happening. But yeah, I mean, in a free-flowing river, it's during the spring when the out-migration happens out to the ocean, these rivers were cranking. You know, there was lots of flow, and it was a good system to get to get young salmon quickly out to the ocean.
But there's also there's a timing issue too, because they're developing, they're changing from aren't they changing from being a freshwater fish to being a saltwater fish, being anadromous fish? So isn't there a concern about if they didn't get down the river soon enough, they would start developing features that aren't going to work while they're still in the estuary waiting to grow up enough to go out into the ocean?
Yeah, I don't know the details of that, but they're certainly changing the timing of all of these, of the out-migration and the migration of the adults upstream matters, right? These are pretty finely tuned evolutionary adaptations that have taken thousands of years to get to where they are, and then we change the flow of the river and it's going to mess with those systems. And the estuary is an incredibly important place in the salmon life cycle, and for our friends down at KMUN, where I get to spend a lot of time in the lower river in Astoria, that's why people are fighting so hard to protect the estuary from things like LNG and, you know, coal and oil terminals and methanol and frack gas, because that's the, you know, as you mentioned, Barbara, that's the nursery for salmon, where these juvenile fish are transitioning into being able to go out into the saltwater and as adults.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Brett Vandenhoevel, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about what can be done to cool the Columbia River so that the salmon can safely return to their spawning grounds. Well, you said a little while ago, Brett, that nobody would build anything today, any kind of industry that would wipe out an entire species. But you just mentioned all the plans for all this kind of development in the Columbia River estuary. So I think maybe that's not really the case.
Yeah, that is true. I shouldn't overestimate the thought process of protecting species. But yeah, I don't want to give too much credit to the federal government either. But, you know, the Columbia system was built at a time when we weren't paying as much attention to the value of salmon. And I think today it would, I hope, be a much different conversation, much different outcome, and that we would respect the treaties that we signed as a government. We would respect the importance of how vital salmon are to our culture and our economy, and we would get a different result.
Well, I want to talk about this long and torturous process of trying to remove the Snake River dams. Let's go back to the beginning of that. And I'm really interested in hearing why you think it's more likely to happen now than it would have 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago, when people started talking about it.
Yeah, so there's, you know, the biological need to remove the Snake River dams has been obvious to scientists for quite some time. And during the Clinton administration, the Secretary of Interior, Bruce Babbitt, actually supported dam removal, and there was some movement from the federal government to do so. It never happened. So that's part of the history. There's been some efforts on and off since then. And today, I think we're in a different position for a couple of reasons. One, as I mentioned earlier, the price of hydropower has dramatically increased. We can now replace those dams with truly renewable energy, and we should. I think the urgency of salmon going extinct is driving some of this conversation forward. Snake River sockeye, which is a miraculous species that spawns in lakes in Idaho and northern Washington, those fish are teetering on the brink of extinction. So there's the biological need, and there's also an economic side now that I don't think we've seen before. As you mentioned, the barging on the Snake River has decreased, and it's less economical, and the dams are getting old. And the maintenance of those and the replacing of turbines and things like that is expensive. And then there's another example of the Port of Lewiston, for example, has some very expensive dredging that would need to happen for, barge traffic to continue. And so weighing all of these economic costs, weighing the opportunity to replace the dams with renewable energy and efficiency, as we're getting more efficient, we're not using more energy in our region, we're using less, provides a really exciting opportunity right now, not to mention the connection with the orcas of needing to try to protect the southern resident killer whales, and just this long-term vision of as a society, are we willing to let runs of salmon go extinct, or do we have the foresight to take some action now to protect those salmon for, you know, future generations?
Well, just as an aside, when you're describing the Port of Lewiston, and I have these images from this wonderful movie that Columbia Riverkeeper helped promote called Dam to Extinction. And they talk in the movie about how there was this vision of Lewiston was going to be the largest inland seaport and the furthest inland seaport probably in the world. And it was going to be a great boon for the economy of Lewiston. And there's these shots of this totally dead downtown with empty storefronts and just a really derelict looking town. So I'm wondering if that reality for those folks up in Lewiston, who probably 20 years ago still believed that this was going to be their salvation, having these dams and having this seaport business, have woken up to the reality that this is not helping their economy at all. And in fact, it's really separating them from the river.
I think of a free-flowing Snake River, you know, it would certainly bring changes to Lewiston in that area, in the surrounding area. But there could be huge benefits. You know, it is really a beautiful area, and there's a lot of amazing recreation and other things and fishing in there. And to bring back some of those, a free-flowing river, you know, there's strong arguments that would be good for the economy. You know, the wheat farmers in eastern Washington and Idaho are already shipping wheat to downriver ports on trains. And it's not like that would kill the farming. It would be a different way to transport wheat. And so, you know, there's a lot of concerns and to change, and it would be a major change. And I don't want to downplay that at all. However, there's some, I think, really exciting change that could come about from that as well. And yeah, the Dam to Extinction movie is done by friend Steve Hawley and Michael Peterson is a really, really powerful piece. And I encourage folks to check that out if you haven't had a chance to see it.
I wanted to talk about this very torturous legal process because I don't remember the details of what it's called now, but it seems like every few years, the U.S. government comes out with a plan to save the salmon. And every time they decide not to take out the dams. And in fact, during the George W. Bush administration, they decided that the dams were a natural feature of the Snake River and the Columbia River.
Yes. Yes. There, a recently released what's called biological opinion once again comes to the conclusion that the dam should stay in. These conclusions, of course, are being made by the federal government, who owns and operates the dams. So this isn't an independent look at, you know, what's good for our society. It wasn't unexpected that would be the conclusion once again.
That report just came out recently, didn't it?
Yeah, so under the Endangered Species Act, they're essentially complete this biological opinion that determines whether this dams are jeopardizing, causing, likely to lead to extinction of salmon. And there's been numerous versions of this. There was a little hope for a better version this time, but it came to very similar conclusions. People are still digging into it, but that was one of the punchlines that got a lot of attention, was that it continues to support the status quo. So we don't have a lot of hope that the federal agencies that manage and own the dams are going to call for their removal. But we do, you know, think that there can be and a big need for leadership from our congressional delegation. They can pass a statute that leads to dam removal. They can come up with a funding package that can have better transportation for trains for wheat to, you know, solve some of those issues. And that's what we're calling for now is leadership from the Northwest delegation to come up with solutions and not rely on the same status quo of the, you know, of these agencies who year after year, decade after decade are going to defend their dams at any cost.
Well, I also have a recollection that after the government comes out with this opinion that we leave the dams in place and they come up with some kind of weak mitigation to supposedly save the salmon, then it's appealed and it goes before this judge, and this judge throws out the government plan and says it's not going to work and that the dams need to be removed. Am I correct about that? There's this kind of process that goes on, and then it just seems like we go around in this circle, and that's what's been going on for 20 years.
Yeah, so a lot of these plans have been challenged. Columbia Riverkeeper has been one of the parties of that, along with many others, and represented by Earth Justice on the kind of environmental group side. And yeah, and those challenges have been successful in saying that the federal government's plan is not adequate. And right now it's in front of Judge Simon. And one of the remedies has been to tell the government that this plan is invalid and you need to go back and comply with the law and create a valid plan. The judge has also been ordering on the ground changes, which have been positive, one of which has been more spill, they call it, which is more flow over the dams instead of going through the turbines. And that has had some good results. And so this cycle of litigation has been happening for a long time. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of suing the federal government when they do something wrong. And I think that that's a necessary thing, but it's not so far leading to the point where we need to be. And that's why we think some, you know, leadership from the Northwest delegation can do a lot more than a court can. You know, the court can essentially say whether this plan is valid or not valid and order some relief. But I think Congress can put together budgets and can put together a more holistic package that is much needed right now.
Well, it seems like even under the so-called more enlightened administration of Barack Obama, there was a lot of issues and that the government never came forward with any better plan, probably a much better plan than the Bush administration had come through. One of the things that disturbed me about Obama is he made some comment about how he didn't understand why there were so many agencies involved with protecting the salmon, because it was a coastal agency and it was an inland river agency. And I thought, this guy needs to learn a little bit about the biology of anatomous fish. So I don't know how much further we've come. I'm not sure if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris know more about anatomous fish than Barack Obama does, but do you think that that's maybe one of the areas where you need to do, we need to do some education?
Yeah, yeah. Oregon, Washington, Columbia River are a long way from Washington, D.C., and I don't think people appreciate the, you know, not only the biology, but the cultural significance, the economic significance. But we do have elected leaders here that do understand those issues, and we need them to step up in a big way and try to solve this problem before it's too late. Democrat or Republican administrations haven't taken the steps necessary on this, and I think part of that is this fidelity towards hydropower and you know, Woody Guthrie singing songs about it and building the Pacific Northwest and the aluminum mills and cheap power. And I think that myth kind of continues to today, and some of that political power from the Bonneville Power Administration continues today, and it is becoming more and more of a myth, and it's just not true anymore that it's cheap power, and people are seeing that, and I think that's really changing the dynamic. And I think there was fidelity to cheap power. I don't think there's fidelity to the dams themselves, right? And so now that the cheap power is no longer there, it really opens up the opportunity to truly save salmon.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about the treaty rights and hoping that we are in a different space now in our history where we maybe can respect the treaties that we've made with all the Indian nations. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the role that the tribes have played, because I'm wondering if that's another wedge that's really reinforcing the position to take out the dams. So what is your relationship with the various tribes along the Columbia River and the Snake River who are being very, very vocal about their concerns about the need to remove the dams?
Yeah, so, you know, Columbia River Keeper as a nonprofit organization that's solely focused on these issues around the Columbia, you know, we understand that we're much different than a sovereign nation, and that sovereign nations are complex and are addressing multiple issues just like any nation would. And we work in solidarity with several tribal nations. We've worked on stopping garbage from being shipped from Hawaii to the Columbia. We litigated with the Yakima Nation. We've worked on with Confederated Tribes Umatillian Reservation on better water quality standards, less toxic pollution, some of the fossil fuel fights. We've worked really closely that have been, you know, in truth, led by the tribal nations standing up for clean water and for our climate. And so I'm really happy with these relationships. But like I said, it's easy for us to talk about dam removal. And it's easy for us to say that these are the steps forward and we need congressional action. And it's, you know, a tribal nation has many other factors that they're considering. And so there's been a lot of effort to restore habitat, and tribes have been leading some of that. And some of that funding has been mitigation from the impacts of the dams. And so environmental groups like Columbia River Keeper and some of our partners have been, you know, much more actively calling for Snake River dam removal. And that hasn't been a position from most of the tribal nations in the Pacific Northwest. The Nez Perce tribe has supported dam removal on the Snake River, which is their, you know, their ceded lands, their traditional territory, and has been the leaders in pushing for protecting Snake River sockeye and Snake River salmon.
Well, and Nez Perce have also, I mean, they've been a leading force in protecting the world from Hanford Reservation as well. I mean, they seem to be really in the lead of working on having a meaningful cleanup. And I found it fascinating last October when they called for the removal of three of the four lower Columbia River dams. So I wanted to talk about that proposal and what it would really mean to all of us, because I think that there is a difference between the four lower Columbia River dams and the Snake River dams in terms of the fact that I'm not sure Portland gets that much electricity from the Bonneville Dam and the Dalles Dam, but there's a lot of areas in the region that get a lot of electricity from those dams. And there's a lot of other issues in which they play an important role. So what would it mean to remove those dams?
Yeah. Yakima Nation in the fall of last year called for removal of the lower Columbia River dams. You know, it is a significant source of electricity. It's also, the dams allow for transportation of barges up and down the river. You know, there's some irrigation that would be, it wouldn't be less water in the Columbia, but some of the infrastructure of irrigation pipes going into the river are, you know, at the level of the reservoirs right now. And so it would be a major impact in the Pacific Northwest. As I mentioned earlier, you know, Yakima Nation asked for Columbia River Keeper support, and we stood in solidarity with them for this call. And I don't want to speak for Yakima Nation, but I admire their bold and long-term vision of trying to think of, as our climate continues to warm, as the Columbia River continues to get warmer, what kind of planning could we do now to think of a future that can support salmon?
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Brett Vandenhoevel, Executive Director of Columbia River Keeper, about what can be done to cool the Columbia River so that the salmon can safely return to their spawning grounds. I've spent a lot of the last 25 years of my life or so since I started learning about what the Columbia River was before the dams went in, trying to envision the river restored. And at one time, I somehow got out on the Bonneville Dam. I've never been able to get to that same place again, but I was standing out on the dam and I was imagining the cascade still running. I want to talk a little bit about the features of the river that have been drowned by the dams and what it would mean to salmon and to people, both native and non-native people in this region, to have that those features of the river back.
Yeah. And again, you know, this is looking into the future, and you know, there's people alive right now that saw Celilo Falls, that watched that drown. These dams haven't been there for, you know, hundreds of years. It's been within certain people's lifetimes, at least for the Dalles Dam and some of the upriver dams. John Day was built in 1972. You know, Bonneville is older than that. It's imagining a free-flowing river, imagining the cascades by Cascade Locks, imagining Celilo roaring. You know, the Hanford Reach of the Columbia is considered the last free-flowing stretch, meaning there's enough, you know, room between, distance between the dams where the river actually flows. And that's my closest way to try to imagine this, is spending a lot of time on the Hanford Reach and doing multiple paddles. And there's not big rapids up there, but the river's flowing and it's amazing. There's riffles and boils and it feels alive. And, you know, you can look down and see gravel where salmon are spawning. Chinook are actually spawning on the main stem of the Columbia up there. And it's just, it's a wild and free flowing river. And to think about that future throughout the basin is, yeah, it'd be an incredible sight to see. There are other places lower down where there's some salmon spawning, and there's one near the Bonneville Dam, just below the Bonneville Dam, and go down there and there's fish in the river and there's eagles flying around and there's sea lions chasing them. And it's an incredible vision to have for the future of a fast, cool, free-flowing river that is supporting salmon and supporting fisheries. We'd have a lot of work to do between now and then, but starting to think of putting, you know, how to replace that power and putting plans in place to have truly renewable powers is something that Yakima has called for. And, you know, there hasn't been much response to that so far.
Well, I'm thinking about these remnants that are left, and you mentioned the salmon that are spawning by the just below the Bonneville Dam. And just below the Bonneville Dam is also where Eagle Creek comes into the Columbia River. And that's one of the places up until 2017 that for years and years I go up every fall and watch the salmon spawning. And I think you can probably do that again now. I think that that part of Eagle Creek is open. And I think I would recommend listeners going out there, or there's several other places on the white salmon. I think there's also places where you can watch them spawn, and just to get a sense of the power of the salmon, and that maybe we can rebuild this image that you're describing, this vision, so that people understand the power of a wild river and start to work towards having that be as big a value as the economic benefits that the rivers, that the dams have played.
Yeah, I had the chance to work on the White Salmon River and the Condit Dam removal. It was about a decade ago now, and more than a decade ago, I think. You know, there's all the concerns, we can't remove the dam. And this is a tributary of the Columbia, but it's the dam finally came out, and it came out with an explosion, and it was this dramatic time. And biologists at the time were thinking it was going to take several years for the salmon to recolonize that. There's going to be all this silt and problems. And, you know, the very next year, there's, you know, we saw salmon jumping up waterfalls and returning to a place they hadn't been in 100 years because of this dam. And, you know, it's a very resilient species, and if we give them a chance, if we're not blocking access, say, on the Snake River with these dams and allow them to get up to some of that habitat, you know, they'll come back if we give them a fighting chance. And I think that's a vision to think about, is some of these tributary dam removals that have been so successful, where we didn't have to do a whole lot other than just to get out of the way.
Well, I was interviewing an Indigenous leader number of years ago for my documentary on the salmon. And he said at the end of the interview that he felt like the salmon were going to survive. He wasn't sure about human beings, but he thought the salmon would make it. And I think that says a lot about the resilience of salmon. What do you think we can learn from salmon's resilience that we can help them to sustain themselves in their resiliency and maybe also learn how to become resilient ourselves?
Yeah, that's a heavy question. I mean, the miraculous journey of salmon that happens every year to the determination of going through, you know, coming out of the ocean, returning to the spawning grounds and surviving predators, surviving pollution, surviving, you know, everything that we're throwing at them and fishing and navigating over these dams. And, you know, I don't want to put it too much in through a human lens, but that's inspiring. You know, anybody who has seen salmon, like you're saying, on Eagle Creek or other places as they're fighting up streams and as they're, you know, digging out reds into the gravel to spawn, that's really inspiring. And I love the connection of how, you know, folks in the estuary that are working to protect that are connected to people way up in these headwater streams. And it's this species that is connecting us all and bringing up, you know, bringing up nutrients from the ocean too. I think about that. I spend a lot of time on the Klickitat River where people are fishing, and there's literally like salmon, you know, they're full of ocean nutrients that have come up and are feeding the forests in the headwaters of the Klickitat and beyond. They've done studies where they're looking and they see these nutrients in the trees. And not only that, but our people are catching them in nets, you know, the tribal fisher people, and this, the nutrients that are feeding families and feeding, you know, I buy fish from them, feeding my family. And all of that's just it's such a gift to have this, to have salmon as part of our lives. And I also find it inspiring all of the hard work that people have done over many years to protect this species and try to restore it. And so there's a lot to be inspired about when it comes to salmon.
Well, Brett, it's great to talk with you. And I hope that one of these days soon I'll get to see you by the river again. Maybe at the next Hanford journey, if we're able to travel by then.
Yeah. Yes, and I appreciate all of your work, Barbara, covering these issues for so many years. And, you know, the journalism that you're doing is a huge part of the protection and conservation of species. So thank you for all that you do.
Well, thanks a lot. Today, we've been talking with Brett VandenHeuvel, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times, if you're able, by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the Donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign about transforming the industrial sacrifice zones along the Willamette River into environments where people and wildlife can once again thrive. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with a song I wrote about the Columbia River. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Spirits asleep in the air, nothing to see, nothing to hear. I watch before me unwind the course of a frozen river of time, carving canyons in the sand, reshaping the land in the palm of your hand. I sit where the river flows. Spirits whisper as the wind starts to blow. Future and past all entwined. A river in motion, yet frozen in time. Carving canyons in the sand. Reshaping the land in the palm of your hand. I sit where the river flows, where the river flows. Reshaping the land in the palm of your hand.